And welcome back to another episode of the Real Conversations podcast. I'm your host, Jacob O'Connor. Today, I'm joined by Sam Parr. Sam, how are you doing?
I'm awesome, man. What's up?
Not much. I thought it would be fun to start this episode with something that you actually have in your LinkedIn bio that I'm going to read it a little bit out of context for people that don't know you, because I think it kind of sets the stage for something. It's like, wait, how does all of this kind of line up and how is that the same person? And then I would love for you to jump in and kind of talk about what is this and how did this story unfold? So it says, I started this in my kitchen with $12 when I was around 25 years old. Company grew to eight figures in revenue with great profits. After 4 years, I sold to HubSpot, a publicly traded company, and a very successful exit. Now called HubSpot Media, The Hustle has a team of nearly 100 people and is read by 3 million people a day, which is just crazy.
Yeah, it might be more now. It could be more. Yeah, that's The Hustle, one of my early ventures that I started in San Francisco.
How are you starting this with $12? Like, kind of walk us through that story.
Yeah, I mean, the internet is awesome because you don't even need $12. When I started my latest business, I started it with nothing. I didn't have a lot of money when I started a lot of my companies. And so I would always just start things with nothing. That particular company, The Hustle, we ended up selling for many, many tens of millions of dollars. And it started as an event. So basically, I had sold another business and I was like, what am I going to do next? And so I created this event called HustleCon. It was kind of like a TED Talk, but for entrepreneurs. And I would convince people to come speak. And then I would go and sell tickets via an email list. So I would like blog like crazy. So I started blogging a lot and I would get traffic to the website and people would sign up to my email list. And then I would email them asking if they wanted to come to the event. And like in 6 weeks, I made like 60 grand in profit. And I was like, well, that's great. Like that's decent money. And the next time I did it, it did like a quarter of a million or 150,000 or something like that. And I was like, this conference business, it's okay, but I don't really want to be like a conference host, like, because if it rains, you're screwed. Like, you know, like it's all on one day. It's a very high risk business. And but all my tickets came via a newsletter that I created. And so I started doing the math and I'm like, if I get 1 million people to sign up to this newsletter, which I think I can, I bet you I could make like $100 million a year. Of course, I was right in that you can make $100 million a year doing it, but you need like 4 million people, of which The Hustle is actually probably close to that. So I sold a little early, but basically I was like, all right, let's create a newsletter because I like writing and the math is such that I think this could be a big company. And so I created The Hustle and it was a daily newsletter that was like Wall Street Journal for like a 28-year-old. We focused on tech and entrepreneurship, but it was news, so business news. And I launched it just out of my kitchen, just writing. And I think in the first year, we got like 100,000 subscribers. The second year, maybe 500,000. The third year, 1 million. And then when we sold in year four, we were getting close to about 2 million subscribers. Now, I'm not involved anymore. I sold it 2 years ago, or I guess almost 3 years ago. Now, it's some number between 3 and 4 million. But that's how that business started.
Is that crazy? Do you think that many people were consuming your content?
Is it crazy? So I don't know if I view it as crazy. I view it as like, I just did the math and I'm like, I think this will work. Yeah, I mean, I guess it's crazy to do it, but like, it's not like it was an overnight thing. You know, the chart of like the business and entrepreneurship is like, it's going great. Oh, this sucks for like 3 months. It's going amazing for like the next month. And then like, oh, this sucks for like the next 4 months. So like it felt like a grind because keep in mind, I'm sending an email every day, six mm-hmm. days a week. It doesn't feel like it was happening that fast. So I was like grinding every day to make that number go up. And so like, for example, my podcast, My First Million, I just looked at the numbers for the first time all year because it's the end of the year. And we've had 100 million listens. And Jesus. So like when I see that number, I'm like, That's a lot of people, but it doesn't feel like that when you're doing the work. So like, is it crazy? I guess looking back, I have a sense of pride and I'm like, yeah, that is wild that I was able to do that. But when you're doing it every day, it feels like this is what I expect to work. And I'm still shocked it worked, but like I was working really hard to make that happen.
Yeah, I always keep the perspective of if I put this many people in a room or an arena or just X, Y, or Z, that's how many people are consuming my content. That's just absolutely absurd. And it's really
yeah. If you look at it that way, it's insane. Yeah, that's insane.
I think something that would be interesting for the listeners. So I'm 22 years old. A lot of my listeners are a little bit older, a little bit younger than myself. You started this in your kitchen at 25 years old. What were you doing?
I think I was 24. I had just turned 25. It was 24 and 25. I'd started about that month.
So what were you doing prior to this? This seems like a pretty unconventional route to get into it. And I think a lot of people would be interested in that.
Yeah. So I was born and raised in St. Louis. When I was 18, I went to Nashville, Tennessee to go to college. When I was in Nashville, I started a hot dog stand. And it was really hard. And it did okay, but it was really hard. I was like outside in 100 degree heat. And so in my free time, I started like a website where I started selling stuff on the internet and I would make money from it, like $100 or $500 a day. And I was like, the internet's awesome. Like, I don't have to be outside. This is great. And I just Googled, like, where do internet companies live? Like, I had never been, I didn't travel. Like, I'm 18 from Missouri. I didn't like have that. Like, I went to Europe once on a school trip, and then I basically just went to Florida. Like, I didn't really go that many places. And on the internet, it said San Francisco. And I'm like, what the hell is San Francisco? That sounds awesome. I thought San Francisco was LA. Like, I didn't know the difference. And I just kept reading that, like, Silicon Valley is where internet companies live. So I moved out there and I just got in the thick of it. And I just kind of showed up without knowing anyone and just started going to meetups. And I met a guy because I rented his, there was this guy who had a spare bedroom in his home, and I rented his bedroom while I was staying there. And he had an idea for an internet company. And I was like, can I help you? Can I be your partner? And I did. And so we started this little roommate matching company, which was like a really stupid idea. And it wasn't that good of a company. It was a bad company. But that's kind of how I got started in San Francisco in 2012. And then we had a very not meaningful exit where we sold the business. And then in doing that, I was able to meet other people and I just networked like crazy. And I actually created a book club called the Anti-MBA. And we would read one book per month and meet weekly. And I called it the Anti-MBA because I had never heard of like what an Ivy League school was. I had only seen Stanford like on the movies. Like, I thought it was some mythical thing. And I was really envious that all these kids had this like amazing network and education. So I was like, I'm going to create my own MBA. And that was kind of the idea. And I would read these books and we would talk about it weekly. And I would have experts come in and lead discussions on the books. And that's kind of how I created my network. And that's kind of, someone gave me the idea of hosting the event, which I then met a guy who had a newsletter. And I was like, that's awesome. But what if we put that on steroids and got like a million people to sign up for it? And that's just kind of how it all kind of came to be.
I love the way that your mind works in that capacity. And one of the things I'm curious about is looking back at that, you're in Nashville, you've got a hot dog stand, it's hot out, it's not maybe going super well. Why was that your mindset of, okay, let's go start an internet company. Oh, this is doing okay. Let's go take off to San Francisco and dive head first rather than I'm in college. Why not just go be an accountant? Like, why was it hot dog stand or San Francisco?
Well, I was majoring in accounting for a minute. So I like accounting. And matter of fact, I'm in a class right now to learn accounting because I forgot what I learned. So I think accounting is great. I just felt like I was destined to be a small business owner. My father's a small business owner. I thought I was going to own like a restaurant or something like that. I didn't really know too much about the internet growing up. I used to sell stuff on eBay. But I guess my logic, I don't know. I just always kind of felt logical of like, my intention was never to like to be rich. Although once I learned about money, I was like, it would be fun to be rich. It was more so like, I just kind of wanted to be in the thick of it and do interesting stuff. And building businesses was basically a dopamine rush for me. And meeting other young people who were doing interesting things, you become friends with them. And I just wanted to one-up each other and push everything to the limit. And I just found excitement in that. And so when I was doing the hot dog thing, I was like, all right, like within a month, I'm like, all right, I already figured this out. I know how to make this work. I'll keep doing it, but there's got to be more. Like, well, how can I push this further? Oh, the internet's awesome. I can reach infinity people because I would sell these hot dogs and I got good at doing it. I could convince people to buy stuff. But then I learned about copywriting. And I'm like, with copywriting, I could get my sales pitch and write it down and perfect it. And it could reach like infinity amount of people. That's why the internet's awesome. And so I just, why did I go to San Francisco and do all that? I don't know. I just thought it was wise to be around people who were better than me and just hopefully I would sink or swim.
Do you think that's more of a short-term view or were you thinking long-term, big picture, it's all going to work out? Or were you just thinking, well, this seems like the right move for this moment of time?
There wasn't long-term vision. No, like I didn't have a vision. I made a vision when I was like 24, 25. Like I like started making goals. No, the goal was just to be in the thick of it. But I did think that it was zero risk. So the way, even at a young age, the way that I kind of figured out how to take risks, I was like, I would measure what's the potential upside and what's the potential downside. So the potential downside, I would try to figure out the potential downside and then cap it. Meaning the potential downside to moving out to San Francisco is I go broke, I run out of money, and I have to move back home with my mom and dad. And so I basically said to my mom and dad, would you allow me to move back home if I fail? And they were like, yeah, of course. So I was like, all right, so what do I need to move back home? I need $500 for a plane ticket. So I just said, all right, cool. I accept that that is my worst case scenario. I've saved $500. I've protected it by asking my mom and dad. I've networked with all these people. So really the more likely worst case scenario is that I will be able to get a job at one of these companies. But the worst case scenario is that I'm going to just like go home and my parents will give me a place to stay. And so I felt like the downside was very well managed and the upside was like a lot of interesting things.
Mm-hmm. So you said when you were 24, you started to start setting goals and maybe thinking more long term. What did that look like for you? I think a lot of our listeners are kind of entering that realm right now where they're realizing you can't just worry about next weekend's party or getting that first job and maybe what's longer and further down the road.
Well, I knew I could just tell because I had like, I don't know if I'd call them mentors, but kind of mentors and people older than me. And I knew that when you're in your early 20s, you don't have a lot of responsibility. I had nothing holding me back. I mean, I didn't have any money, but I had nothing holding me back. And so I was like, all right, so it's imperative that I get my first base hit while I'm young. And I talked to a bunch of rich people and I was like, how much do you spend per month? And like one rich guy was like, I spend 80 grand a month or something like that, which is $1 million a year. And then I looked it up. I'm like, all right, so how much money do I have to make that if I have this lump sum saved up and invested in just public stocks that I could withdraw enough money to last for 80,000 a month forever? And that number was something like $20 to $25 million. So I said, all right, I'm going to make about $25 million by the time I'm 30.
Easy.
And well, it's easy to say. But then I was like, all right, to do that, that means I either have to make a company that makes, you know, let's say $5 million in profit for 5 years, or I have to build a company that I could sell for like tens of millions of dollars by the time I'm 30, which means I have to make a company that can get to like 20 million in revenue by the age of 30, which means in order to get to 20 million revenue, I need to reach this many people and sell my product for this amount of money. And so I just like reverse engineered. I'm like, okay, cool. So I need to get there by year five. That means by year one, I should be around here. Year two, I should be around here. In order to get there, here's like my framework. And that's kind of how I worked backwards.
Did it end up taking 5 years or how long was it?
I sold my company in 2021, I think, right when 2021 happened. So I was, I think I was 31. So it, the business started as like a blog and then I pivoted it to become just a newsletter and I launched it in April 19th of 2016 and I sold February of 21. So it took four and a half years.
That is incredible. I mean, that it, usually I feel like the time horizon is 10 to 15 years for something like that. Whenever people try and go that route of being acquired, at least that's what I feel like I always see.
Yeah. I think most people are, well, so on one hand, things do take longer than you want. Like my goal with that business, I said what my goal was, but in the back of my head, I was like, man, I think this could reach 100 million in revenue. And I was right. It could. So like the numbers that we're doing now, that could be 100 million in revenue. But I sold early. So in one regard, it would have took me 10 years to get to 100 million in revenue. But on the other hand, I actually think that most people aren't intense about what they're going after. And they aren't fast on a day-to-day basis. I'm quite fast on a day-to-day basis. And most people aren't fast, but they could be if they wanted to.
What would be an example of being fast on a day-to-day basis?
So I've got a homemade tattoo on my feet that say act now.
That's
and
awesome.
So like, yeah. And so I've been like that since I was like 19. But like, for example, a really simple example, a drunken conversation with friends on a Friday of like, I should get a hot dog stand, to like buying the hot dog stand on a Sunday. And then like getting a permit on a Monday. Like that's like a tiny example. When it comes to internet stuff, it's like, I try not to plan too much, because I'm like, instead of planning, I'm just going to do the thing. So you have an idea for your business. Okay, let's build a website literally right now. And 6 hours later, let's buy ads on Facebook and drive $1,000 of ads to the website and see if anyone converts. Or we'll have like a landing page that asks for people's phone numbers, like if they're interested in buying our product. And let's call them and get them on the phone tomorrow and talk to 20 people and figure out like why they're interested in my product. And then let's literally build the product on day three and let's have it in their hands on day eight, like moving really quickly. And then on day 20, I want 100 customers, like just like really going quickly and iterating fast is what I believe. You can't do that for every type of product, but for some you can.
So if you act fast, are you also testing? What is your testing period like? Are you quick to shut things down, or are you allowing for time of perseverance and things to normalize?
Well, that's the art. You know, entrepreneurship is a science and an art. So the art is figuring out like what's promising and what's not. And like, it's challenging. You know, that's just like to build a big business, you don't need that many people to like your thing. Like, for example, if you talk to 20 people who are interested in your thing, depending on how you price it, like there's likely going to be hundreds or thousands, or in the case of the hustle, millions of people who also want that thing. So I don't need to go out and do like some crazy research. It's like, well, these 20 people like it, and I just have a feeling there's lots more people who want it. And that's all I need to know. Mm-hmm. I don't need to you know, when I run a business, I think of like, all right. Or a good analogy that we say on the podcast is A, B, C, Z, meaning Z is like my end vision. Like one day I could have this huge media company that employs tens of thousands of people, and it's like CNN or Fox or something. Or I could have a whole restaurant chain like Raising Cane's, and A is just a hot dog stand, mm-hmm. or 1,000 people on my newsletter. B is 5,000 people on my newsletter and like $10,000 a month in revenue. But then I don't give a shit about step C or anything in between C and Z. I don't think about any of that stuff. That's not important. I just need to have the big vision to help encourage me and inspire me. And then I only need to worry about the next step. I don't let any of the other steps bother me.
I like that. So on the one hand, you could start a business. You could start a business like The Hustle, and you could get acquired in 4.5-5 years, which worked out well for you. If you could go back, or you had to do something right now, would you go the route of trying to get acquired? Or what about the route of starting a business and living off the cash flows? And maybe it takes you 10 years to get acquired for 50 million. That's 5 million a year. Or you have a cash flowing business that you're making 5 million a year.
So that's a good and interesting question. I think that for me, I wouldn't change anything because I got the desired outcome.
Mm-hmm.
So I had given equity to some employees and stuff. And so I owned most all the company, but I didn't own 100% of the company. And when you don't own 100% of the company, you sort of have a fiduciary duty to like treat everyone respectfully and do the right thing for all shareholders. If I owned 100% of it, maybe I wouldn't have sold, and I just would have paid myself millions and millions of dollars, or taken the millions of dollars and invested it into other things. But that wasn't an option. So I don't regret selling for one minute. I would say that it's an 95% sure that we would be we'd be doing some huge range of 50 to 100 million in revenue now, and that would be worth anywhere from $100 to $250 million in value. I can't say that I was mature enough or talented enough to actually do it. I think I could do it now, but I wasn't then. So I don't regret it at all. I regret that I wasn't wealthy in advance and I had to sell in order to hit my goals. Like that, if that type of business that I had, that's a great company to own for a long period of time. Mm-hmm. But I don't regret selling even remotely. And if you do the math, to acquire the amount of money that I made or to acquire a large sum of money, it's not impossible, but it's quite hard to do at a young age without selling a company. Mm-hmm. I could name many examples of people who have done it, but it's just a lot, I think, more likely to do it by selling an asset as opposed to cash flowing one.
Mm-hmm. And I don't know what the multiples look like on a newsletter or media business, but I would imagine that having a multiple helps rather than just straight cash distributions annually.
Well, yeah. So it depends on the market. So for media companies, it depends on who your user is, and it depends on if the economy is good. But anywhere from 2 to 6 times revenue is like the massive range. Mm-hmm. So, or it could be 10 to 25 times EBITDA. And so that's like but if someone's willing to pay you 20 times profit, you're getting 20 years of payment up front. Mm-hmm. So like, that's like pretty substantial.
Not a bad deal at all. From consuming your content and watching your podcast, you kind of strike me as someone who works obsessively, which is something that is awesome because you can move quickly and you can get things done. Do you feel like there's been, how have you had to balance, I don't like the word balance, how have you had to integrate that with your personal life? And, you know, handle on the one hand that you want to get things done, you want to hit these goals, but you also want to enjoy the ride as you're going on it.
Well, I don't think I work obsessively. I think I'm obsessed. Mm. I think I'm definitely obsessed where I'm always thinking about stuff, but maybe it's sort of just like an athlete where they're just like thinking like, I got to work out tomorrow. I wonder if I can do this much weight for this many reps. And in order to do that, I should probably go and eat this food now or ice this shoulder now. Or like, man, I regret that. Like I missed this shot. Like I'm obsessed and I always think about it. But my work habits are a little bit like a lion where like I'll lounge for a while and plot. And then when I see like prey, I'll sprint and go high intensity and get the kill. But I would say I'm not nearly as hardworking as people think. I mean, I would say that like if you measured out my actual sitting down and doing work, I would imagine it's a normal 40-hour work week. Mm-hmm. But I am incredibly obsessed. And all I think about, like I'm able to compartmentalize and be like, all right now it's family time. I'm going to try and shut it up. But if I don't shut it up, all I think about is business. Yeah.
Yeah. That ability to unplug is something that I think it's increasingly difficult. I really enjoy taking ice baths. That's one way that like really gets me just to kind of reset and come back to that moment. Is that something that you found has kind of helped as well? Or have you never really had too much of an issue with that?
Yeah, I mean, I do ice baths. I have motorcycles, so I ride motorcycles a lot. Usually I try to do high intense activities because that's the only way that I can calm down. So like when I work out, I work out fairly intensely. When I watch sports, I basically pay attention to zero sports other than UFC, because I like to box and things like that. Mm-hmm. So I usually like to do high intensity things, as that's the only thing that can kind of make me shut up. But yeah, I do a fair amount of that, and I also just sit and I'm lazy and I'll read a ton. I read a lot. I read a lot of history books, and that's like one of the ways that I unwind.
If you could recommend one history book, what would it be?
It depends which era you're into. My favorite era is like America from 1880 to like 1930. I think the best one that I've read as of late is The Patriarch, which is the story of Joe Kennedy, the father of JFK. Mm. The reason I like that is I think that America is the greatest country on earth. And like the 1920s was like We're sort of in our teenage era. There wasn't a lot of regulation. There weren't too many rules. It was a little bit of the Wild West. And Joe Kennedy, he was almost like the Kardashian of like the 1920s. Like, he shaped culture. And I think it's really fascinating that a nobody like Joe Kennedy can work his way up and have upward mobility and kind of kick his dent in the universe and shape American culture. And I'm super fascinated by that. And that's one of the reasons why I love America. It's one of the few countries where if you have a good idea and you work hard, you can really bend the culture to your will. And I think that's fascinating.
Do you read a book like that and about someone like Joe Kennedy and think, how can I apply something like this into my life?
Yeah, more often than not, it's how do I avoid what he did? So for Joe Kennedy, he was a pretty shitty husband, and he was both a horrible father and a wonderful father. He did a lot of great things and a lot of bad things. And he was a very unethical businessman. And so usually what I do is I read a lot of biographies and I read a lot of history, because I want to spot patterns and I want to avoid the mistakes that they're making on my behalf. And I can like see like, like, for example, had Hitler just read about Napoleon, he would have known you don't invade Russia in the wintertime. That ruins you. You don't do that. And so like you can, you know, study these things where it's like, don't do X, Y, and Z, and I'll avoid it. And, you know, basically my philosophy on history is human nature has always and will always be the same. The tactics, you know, AI, the internet, that's going to change. But we're all greedy. We all want a tribe of people. We're all going to have envy. And how do I manage that as I go? And so that's why I read a lot of history.
Yeah, it is interesting to see the duality of it. Like, you have a highly successful person and they're excelling in one area, but it's also, you read the book and you realize, man, they are really struggling and lacking in this other area. And how can I not fall into that same trap and pit that they are?
Well, and that's another thing that I've kind of learned, which is, most every great man's also a bad man. Meaning, in order to be great, you're going to piss off a lot of people, but you have to make sure you piss off the right people and don't piss off the wrong people. And in order to be a great athlete, in order to be a great marathon runner, you got to be incredibly skinny, which means you kind of got to undereat. You probably, your hormones are going to be crazy unbalanced. You're likely not going to look good naked, but you're going to perform super well. And that's sometimes the case with business or with performance in any other aspect of life. You're going to avoid your family. You're going to be an asshole. You're going to lie, cheat, and steal. And the goal, in my opinion, is to succeed in business while being honest and treating my family wonderfully. And so you have to figure out, you know, where I can cut corners, meaning like where I can cut time. So I just can't be social, but I'm going to work out, and I'm going to be with my kids, and I'm going to be with my wife, and I'm going to be with business. So basically like figuring out like, where can I be a performance athlete and where I should like completely ignore.
Mm-hmm. I love that. One thing that I was curious too, in thinking about today's episode, was that you went from the hustle to My First Million, which is, again, it's been a massive hit. You talked about 100 million downloads, views for this 2023 year. Why? What is it about podcasting? Is it something similar to reading the book and learning about the history of someone and maybe avoiding their pitfalls and seeing their hacks to success that you enjoy about podcasting? Or what is it that you like?
I don't even like it that much, for the record. Like, my podcast, basically The Hustle owned My First Million. And the way it started is Sean, who was one of my great friends at the time, successful entrepreneur, he had an idea for this podcast, but he didn't have an audience. You know, he was, quote, a nobody. He wasn't really a nobody, but he didn't have like a big audience. And The Hustle at the time probably had a million subscribers. And he was like, I got this idea for a podcast called My First Million, where I interview these people and I ask them how they got their first million users or their first million revenue, whatever. I said, great. The Hustle will own it and we'll publish it, and I'll give you 50% of all the revenue that we make off of it. So we did that for like 3 months. And Sean was like, I can't really get any guests this week, but I got the studio booked. You and I, Sam, we have brainstormed and we do these things that we always do where we like riff on business ideas. Just come and do that. And I was like, all right, fine, I'll do that. But I don't like podcasts. Like, I don't want this to be my thing, but I'll do it. And so we did it. And it kind of, it didn't take off right away, but it got a lot of love. And we were like, you just want to do this every week? Let's just do this one day a week. And it just, over the few months, it started growing. And then we're like, you want to do this twice a week? I'm like, all right, sure, let's do it twice a week. And then now we do it 2 to 3 times a week. And it's, we started that, I think, in, when did we start it? I don't know. You could, we're 550 episodes in. And so I don't remember when we started doing that. 3 years ago, maybe. And just like every month, it's just started getting better and better and better and better. And I consider it like exercise. Like there's a lot of mornings where I'm like, oh, I don't want to do this. And then I get into it and I'm like, this is awesome. I love it. But the thing about podcasting is like, I'll mention, like the other day, we had this lady who used to work for me named Steph on the podcast. And like in minute 60, she mentioned this new product that she was working on. And within 24 hours, it made $100,000 in sales. And so it'll be crazy that like people list, so many people listen and they listen so closely that they like pay attention to the smallest things. And so it's pretty amazing that like that's one of the great benefits, I guess, of having a podcast is that it will have that much, I don't know, engagement. But the downside of a podcast, as I'm sure you've seen, is I've grown email lists, blogs, conferences, software businesses. Podcasting is the hardest one to grow, without a doubt. It is without a doubt the hardest thing that I've ever had to grow. And had I known it was going to take as long as it did to get to a point where I'm like, all right, we've done something interesting, I don't think I would have done it. I didn't realize it was going to take this long. I thought it was going to take a year and a half. It took like 4 years, or I think we're 3.5 in. I didn't realize it was going to be this hard. It's really hard to grow, and it's hard work. It's hard work. And so like we've succeeded so far. Like I can't replicate that success. I don't know why it succeeded.
So that's interesting to me that you say that you don't like podcasting, but you get into it and you do enjoy it. And then you kind of comparing that to working out. So would you say that you don't enjoy working out either, or is it just,
no, I mean, not really. Like half the time I don't want to do it. Like if I could look awesome and feel awesome and not do it, that'd be great. I mean, what I mean is it's just hard work. Like it's hard. Like there's days where I'm like, I don't feel like talking today. So it's just work. And I'm very grateful that I make a lot of money doing something that looks like a play. And half the time it is play, but it's hard work. It's really hard.
Yeah. No, that makes sense. You talked about it took you longer to grow the podcast than you thought. What were some of the maybe tips or things that you learned along the way that you think kind of helped that growth?
Well, the easiest one, which is hard to replicate, is The Hustle had 1 million subscribers when we launched. So the first episode had 60,000 downloads. And then it like you for the next 3 months, it dropped every week. So the first one came out with 60,000, and then it went down to like 5 or 10,000 downloads. Oh, and then from like 5 or 10,000 downloads per episode, we just crawled our way up. And the easiest way to grow is to get big name guests, which is, that's not easy, but that's simple. It's hard to get. Another way is to become a guest on other podcasts. Another way is just to be an interesting person. So like, in my opinion, there's basically 3 attributes that make a great podcast, and you don't need all 3, but basically it's like stellar production. So that would be like a Wondery podcast where they like interview like experts on these topics and they weave it all together in this amazing story, or they have a voice actor. That's not my first million. When we started doing it, for the first 2 years, we just recorded on AirPods and our iPhone. Our production was horrible. The second thing, attribute, is you just have like the best host ever. So like your host could be like Theo Von. So like a lot of comedy podcasts fall into this category where they're just like funny and they're fun to listen to. Right. And you're like, dude, I'll listen to you talk about anything. You're just fun. We partially fall in that category. Sean, my partner, is quite funny and he could talk about anything. And then the third category is having an interesting perspective. So like the extreme example is like LeBron James. If LeBron James has a podcast on basketball, you're gonna be like, dude, he's like the greatest in the world. And he's been inside the locker room. He could tell me everything. If I'm a basketball fan, I'm going to listen to that. In our case, I was building a business that was doing tens of millions in revenue. So like I knew a thing or two about business. Sean had a successful company and we've invested in hundreds of companies. So like we have a few interesting insights. And so we more so fell into the third and second category. But that's kind of like what you need, in my opinion, to succeed.
Do you ever listen to Acquired or Founders, the podcast?
Yeah, I love Founders. David Senra is a badass. He's a good friend of mine. He's the best. Acquired with Ben and what's the other guy's name?
Ben and Ben wrote Adam. Oh my gosh.
Adam, no, not Adam.
I was just listening to this. Acquired.
They've been on my podcast. David, Ben and David. I love those guys. I was blanking on a name. Yeah, I think they're beautiful. I think Acquired and Founders, they do a pretty good job at delivery. So they have nice voices to talk to listen to. Ben and David also are investors, so they see a lot of interesting stuff. But what they do is their experience, in that David from Founders has read so many books, and he does such a great job of delivering it. And same with Ben and David, they research like crazy. And so, I love those two podcasts.
Yeah, I find that them, specifically Founders, is interesting because they didn't launch off of a newsletter, like you mentioned. That kind of helps with a little bit of early momentum. He just was reading books and obsessing over them and wanting to share that with people. And you look at the trajectory that he's on and how quickly it's grown, or I guess how large it's grown.
There's one thing in there that you're forgetting, which is Founders ended up joining a podcast network, Colossus, which is started by Patrick O'Shaughnessy. In my opinion, it's one of the best business podcast networks out there. And what they did was Patrick's podcast would promote David's, which is the same thing as becoming a guest sort of on other podcasts. And so David Founders was an excellent podcast. And then also he got that boost. Which is like one of the secrets to growing.
Yeah, I've heard of Colossus. I wasn't actually sure how they functioned. That's interesting.
It's basically a media company. So they own, I think, most of their podcasts, and they sell ads on them. And then they find interesting people like Founders, and they say, hey, you can own the podcast. It's yours, but we'll put our ads on it, and we get half the money and you get half the money. And also, as you grow, which you're going to, we're going to help you grow by promoting you on all our podcasts. As you grow, you're going to promote us or our other podcasts on yours. And so it's a mutually beneficial agreement.
That is really interesting. Are you able to leave that at some point in the future, or are you always kind of tied in?
Well, I don't know. Every deal is different. So yeah, I'm sure he could leave at any point. Well, I don't know what he could do, but oftentimes you could leave, or there's like a 4-year agreement. Yeah. But in order to get into those, you have to be good. You know, like you've got to convince someone that you've got some type of it factor.
Mm-hmm. Well, Sam, as we look at 2024 coming up here, what has you excited?
So I'm way more boring than a lot of people think. Like I get up at 7 and I go to bed at 10. Like I'm a pretty boring person. What makes me excited is just like compounding. So like, just like if I've got this new company called Hampton, like if that just like, I want that to double, but if it like only grows by 30% for 10 years, I'll be very happy. And so I don't really have shiny object syndrome too much. I'm pretty focused on doing the same thing over and over again for like a decade. I have shiny object syndrome like everyone else, and I satisfy those urges by doing little tiny projects, but really what I'm excited about is just doing the same shit over and over and over again. So MFM got 100 million, maybe 200 million next year. But I don't set too many goals. I just kind of try to do the same thing over and over again and just get a little bit better. It's super boring. It's way more boring than people think.
No, I love compounding though. I always think about it as compounding consistencies. And this is something that I commonly talk about on the podcast. Of most people think about it in terms of money. And it's more than that. It's what you're doing on the day-to-day basis, and it's going to be incremental growth, but over a long enough time horizon, it's going to look like that hockey stick curve, hopefully, if you're doing something right. And I think that as boring as that is, it's what it's required often to get the type of growth that you want, to have that outcome that you want.
Yeah, and that's what excites me. What excites me is looking back in 10 years and being like, I'm so pumped I started that thing when I did start it, because now I got something interesting on my hands, and that excites me. Some more boring things, but personal stuff is like, I had a daughter recently, so I'm excited to see her grow.
Congratulations.
I'm excited to kind of transition from, you know, how old are you?
22.
I'm excited to, you know, like I was, when I was 30, I still felt 22. So like I kind of acted like a kid a lot of times, and I'm excited to kind of transition from kind of being a loose cannon, uncalculated young guy to more of a, you know, act my age type of thing and kind of get some stuff together. So I'm really excited about becoming a family man and just like transitioning from, you know, I don't know what comes after 30. I guess your 40s and 50s are more established. I don't know what's going to happen then. But as my 20s, I was like a super scrappy kid. And I was in Missouri. You're from Missouri. You know the word Hoosier?
Yep.
I was about as Hoosier as you can get. Like I'm barefooted and shirtless half the time. Like I'm excited to transition from becoming like a wild kid to like a wild adult, you know, like a grown man that's got his act together, but still has a little bit of edge in him.
Yeah. It's something that I don't understand yet, but I have three older siblings and they're kind of starting to have kids, and to see them go from that person that they were knowing growing up to like now they're a parent with this incredible responsibility, in my opinion, the greatest responsibility ever. You have to become a different person if you want to do it right, however you define that.
Yeah, but the key for me is to keep your edge and not let, you know, like the world wants you to be vanilla. And you have to do whatever it takes to not become that. And so I love rebelling against that. And I think that it's going to be exciting to do that as I have a family and more responsibility. But the world wants you to fit into this box. And I love fighting that. I get a lot of energy out of doing what I'm told not to do. And I think that the goal is to grow up and take care of your business and your responsibilities, but doing it your way. And so I get excitement about pointing and saying, here's the path and here's the rules I've created for myself and here's the rules I'm going to play. And then actually doing it, regardless of if those rules are agreed upon by other people.
In this context, the box you're talking about, how do the rules that you want to set differ?
Well, I don't know exactly. I've lived my life a fair bit not paying attention to a lot of other people's rules, but the rules that I like live by are now, which is I'm only going to work on things that excite me, which I do. As I get older, I'm going to get healthier and better looking. So like I was a Division I athlete, so I used to be like a machine, and then I got fat and like lazy for a minute, and then now I've gotten healthier. And so like people say, like, as you get older, you're going to get fat and not work out. And I'm like, nah, screw that. I'm going to get better as I get older. So I really believe in that. And so I'm trying to do that. You know, that whole dad bod thing, F that. I'm not going to have a dad bod. I'm going to look great and feel great.
Dad bods are in, I've heard.
Well, I don't give a shit if they're in. They're not in the Parr household. I'm not going to be doing that. So like to be able to be like strong and fit is important to me. To have a good debate, like in my opinion, where I am now, my number one responsibility is to be a good husband and a good father. So that goes first no matter what. So, you know, I think there's a lot of businessmen that have success that are willing to sacrifice family life. That ain't me. I'm not going to do that. I don't know. Those are some of the rules that I'm playing by at the moment.
Was it important to you to have success in business prior to having a family, or did it just...
Without a doubt. Without a doubt. And I don't like talking about this because it's an irreversible thing and I don't want people to feel bad and I don't want to like brag. But the truth is I like had this, I had this insight. It's not a terribly insightful or unique insight, which is getting rich before you have kids is an unfair advantage. And there's no doubt about that. Having money before you have a kid, so when you have a kid, you're less stressed. It is without a doubt easier and better. Again, I don't like talking about that because I don't want people to feel bad, because you can't go back in time, but you can fix where you are. But it's an advantage to do it before you have children. It's way easier. It's way easier. There's no doubt about that. So even before I met my wife, I was like, when I have a wife, she's going to be taken care of. When I have a kid, I'm only going to have to worry about my emotional needs, or I'm going to only have to provide emotionally and spiritually for them. I will not have to worry about how I'm going to afford braces for them. You know what I'm saying? And yeah. So that was imperative that I figured that out before I had a family.
Did you intentionally hold off on finding your wife until you felt like you were at a point to where you could do that? Or was it you're just holding off?
No. I started dating my wife when I was 25. So it worked. We were together when I was starting the company. No, I didn't. But I just remember thinking, like, we almost had like a, it sounds callous, but it wasn't. We had like a business agreement where it was like, all right, Sarah, by the time I'm 30, you're going to be 27. Here's the type of life we want. We want to live in this amount, this type of home. We want to spend this much per month. We want to do this. That means that for the next couple of years, you're responsible for this. I'm responsible for this. So for my responsibility, it was make my company successful and do X, Y, and Z. Although my wife, Sarah, was a self-made millionaire before I was. She was early at Airbnb. And she was definitely the breadwinner on paper. Or at least in cash wise. And so it was like, here's the goals. Here's where we want to be. I'm going to get after it. And I'm willing to sacrifice these next 5 years in order to provide for the next, 80 years. And so we like had very distinct goals and agreements on what type of life we have or wanted to have and and the sacrifices we were going to make for the next 3 to 5 years as we were dating. So it was like, live in a crap apartment. Like be frugal, only buy clothes if they're on sale, like only spend this much money per month. This way we can do this later. And so it was like we had very set goals.
That's very contrarian to, I feel like, what most people do. I mean, how minute were you getting with it? Were you budgeting? Were you checking?
Hell yeah. Yeah. We had a meeting once a month where we would say, all right, our budget was 10 grand this month or 8 grand or whatever it was. Here's how much we spent. Next month, we can't do X, Y, and Z. Yeah. It was, or Sam, your business did this much in revenue. You got to step it up in order to like hit your targets like you said you were going to, and it wasn't like her saying, I need you to do this. It was like, hey, you said you wanted this. Get after it. Come on.
It's the accountability.
Yeah. And it was we totally had a partnership like that. I don't budget anymore, but like I had this app called My Weekly Budget, and I had a $500 a week budget, and I would write down every time I spent a cent. Yeah, I budgeted like crazy.
That's super interesting.
Well, and like I had this spreadsheet where it was like, all right, here's the trailing 6 months that we spent. The average was this. I have this much money. That means we're good for the next 24 months. How do we extend that to 36 months? How do we extend that to 5 years, whatever. But yeah, it was like super detailed.
That is super interesting. Sam, as we start to wrap up, I have a couple quick questions for you. The first one being, if you could have dinner with any three people, past, present, or I guess you can't do future, but past or present, who would you pick?
So I really admired John Rockefeller. He founded Standard Oil. So I think I would like to meet with him. Let's see, who else? Jackie Kennedy, so JFK's wife.
Mm-hmm.
She was only 35 years old when he was assassinated, but she was incredibly poised and went through a lot of tragedy in her life with a very poised manner. So I would love to meet her. And then Ted Turner is one of my heroes. He has dementia now. He's going to die any day, I would imagine. But younger Ted Turner, I would love to hang out with him because he was a wild man. I always admired him because he was from Georgia. I'm from Missouri. Missouri is not exactly the South, but according to New Yorkers, they kind of view us as rednecks. And he was that, but he built CNN and kind of took over New York City. So I think I would do Ted Turner, Jackie Kennedy, and John Rockefeller.
What would you ask Rockefeller?
I would get into all of his deals and he was a real fascinating guy because I'm not religious at all, but he was real religious and he felt that his skill set was making money and he owed it to God and the world to accumulate as much money as possible in order to distribute it as he saw fit. So he basically helped create the modern hospital and he funded a lot of the first early black universities and he did all this amazing philanthropy. I would probably want to like get into his mindset of what drove him to become so maniacal about business.
Yeah. I listened to Standard Oil part 1, 2, and 3 on The Acquired. And was it Founders? Regardless, it was incredible. Like going into the history of John D. Rockefeller is something that, because his dad was crazy. And
his dad was an asshole. His dad was cheated and wasn't around. And his dad was a real jerk, but he came from nothing. And had he, you know, in terms of historical money, he would have been the richest person to ever live. And the interesting thing about him is he did lie a couple times. There's a few times where it's documented that he wasn't lying, but he, like when he was on trial for something, he admitted some truth. But in general, given all that he accomplished, he was a very ethical man, and he was a wonderful father and a wonderful husband. And so he mostly treated people wonderfully, and he mostly was incredibly honest.
Mm-hmm.
And so I find that fascinating.
I also agree to your point of his relationship with money. I know that he had become the man of the household at like 10 or 13 or something super early. And he started off like keeping books for people because he said he wanted to make a lot of money. But in order to make a lot of money, you have to first respect and understand how money works. And so he was just maniacal to the detail about all of the currency in the book and where it was going.
Yeah, I still haven't entirely grasped that. So like I wasn't born, I think, with like understanding numbers, but he understood compounding growth really well. And like, for example, I don't really buy companies. I think buying a company is silly. It's not silly. I just don't understand it. Mm-hmm. But he understood how to consolidate businesses in order to unlock value. And I think that's a real art. And I'm incredibly fascinated by people who are able to do that, who are able to see like how to unlock value by looking at accounting and looking at numbers. That doesn't come naturally to me, but I think it's really amazing for people who are able to figure that out.
Mm-hmm. Well, hopefully your accounting course will help with that.
I'm trying, man. I'm trying. I guess even a blind squirrel finds a nut once in a while. So I'm trying to learn and figure out how to do it.
Yep. Broken clock's still right twice a day. So Sam, you said here at one point that your goal in life is never to be in a situation where you're forced to wear khaki pants.
Yeah.
Talk to me about this.
Well, I just don't ever want to be, my whole position in money is, I don't care if you think capitalism is evil or is not evil. You have to agree that in this lifetime, it ain't going anywhere. And if that's true, the person that has not the most money, but enough money that they can do whatever they want and they could tell anyone they want to go fuck themselves, they are in a position of power. And that is my goal, is to be in a position of power, which I believe I am in now, where no one is going to tell me what to do or how to live my life. And I hated wearing khaki pants. And I remember like having to go to like these accounting internships and like act like someone I wasn't. And I like did that a couple times and I'm like, screw this, man, I'm never doing that again. And the way to do that is to accumulate money. And I don't need to be a multi-billionaire. Maybe I will be, maybe I won't. I don't need that to be happy, but I need enough that I can give the bird to anyone I want to and do whatever the hell I want to do with me and my family. And I only want to take care of the people I care about, and everyone else can go screw themselves. And I want to live my life a little bit like a pirate ship, where if you're on board, you're with me. And if you're not on board, I don't care. I'm going wherever I want to go. And the most practical way to do that is to have money. And so that's why I kind of have always said that I don't want to be in a position where I've got to wear khaki pants.
I love how it's such a seemingly surface level statement has such a deep meaning and context to you.
Yeah, I mean, that's why I'm obsessed. It's all rooted in power. And I don't need power over other people, but I need power over myself. I only live one life. I'm only going to be here for 80, hopefully 100 years. And I'm going to do it my way. And a very practical way to do that, not the only way, but a very practical way to do that is to have money.
Yeah, I love that. Sam, we talked about this earlier. Where can people find you online if they want to connect or learn more?
The Sam Parr on Twitter, my new company, joinhampton.com. My First Million is the podcast, but I'm most active on Twitter.
Great. Sam, thank you for coming on. My final question for you is, looking back at this really cool journey you've been on, what advice would you give to your 22-year-old self?
What advice would I give to my 22-year-old self? I used to think that if someone went to a good school, or if someone had a great job, or if someone was older than me, that they were more qualified or better than I was to start a business, or that they knew what they were talking about with certain topics. And what I've learned is that is not true. What I've learned is that confident people lead, and the most powerful skill set you can have is to convince others to follow you. And hopefully you have a good idea and you're getting, but ultimately a company, which you need to accumulate, a company is just a group of people you've convinced to row in the same direction towards a similar goal. And I wish I would have learned earlier that not a lot of people are skilled to do that. And I think I had the skill at a young age in order to do that, but I was quite intimidated. So I would tell 22-year-old me, no one knows what they're talking about, oftentimes myself included. So I should just be more aggressive and get out there and get after it.
Thank you for coming on, Sam.
I appreciate it.